This is Ashley Anderson of the group Peaceful Uprising, working statewide in Utah and centered in the Moab area. Interviewed November 21st at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana. Okay, so it's Ashley and... what's your last name?
Anderson.
Okay, and you're with a Utah group, or are you just starting a group? Or
I'm with a group called Peaceful Uprising. We're based in Utah. We're a climate justice group.
Okay, and so what is going on? I understand there was approval just given this week for a tar sands type of extraction, maybe strip mining in Utah. What's going on there?
Well, it wasn't this week, but there's a company called Earth Energy Resources. It's a Canadian company that claims to have a new method of extracting the tar from the bitumen that's you can get from strip mining, and they want to use it in Utah. They've already got the lease on 62 acres. They plan to expand to over 180 acres. They haven't actually started mining yet, except for one test pit. We're appealing the decision by our regulatory agencies there, which is the Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining. But so far, they have gotten approval to go ahead with it. However, we are appealing it.
And is this method different than what's being used in Alberta?
Yeah, the traditional methods of removing the actual oil from the other things like the clay and the sand is primarily chemical based and steam based and uses lots of water, and we just don't have that kind of water in Utah. So apparently they've got something that uses a lot more chemicals and natural gas to melt it out.
Tell me a little bit about the location where this is going on and what possible ecological impacts.
Well, for those familiar with Utah, it's around the middle of the state and off to the right. So it's in the eastern part of the state, it's within eyeshot of Arches National Park. But the actual surface strip mining would kick up enough dust that it would affect, you know, photographs taken of, say, you know, up in the Fiery Furnace and other iconic spots.
Uh-huh. And as far as size, how does this compare to the Alberta tar sands?
Well, Utah has tar sands deposits that account for about 92% of all those in the 48 states, or in all 50 states. And the actual size of that they're spread out is not nearly as large as the Alberta tar sands or Venezuela's, but it does account for a very large amount of oil and a very large area that would be equivalent to, say, you know, the greater LA, you know, area, with including all the mountains and everything like that, if they were to bulldoze it all. And that's just in the easily extractable area.
And what sort of ecosystem is in this area? I mean, and I assume it would be destroyed by this activity.
Definitely. What we're looking at is it's in the Colorado River drainage, and it's at the top of it at about 8,000 feet. So it's very high desert. You know, it's a mixture of sagebrush and, you know, pine trees, you know, scattered here and there. It's very arid, and it's just basically like rolling hills. It's a plateau, and the other half of the plateau that isn't, you know, state land or federal land is actually tribal land. So it's just basically high desert country.
So it's the Ute tribe. Are they against this?
The Ute tribe hasn't taken an official stand on this. However, traditionally speaking, they have been in favor of the resources that can be gained by supporting mineral extraction in the state.
Okay. And I guess I want you to go a little bit more into the methods. Is this actually strip mining? Are they taking the surface off?
Yes. It's giant bulldozers scooping up the ground, ripping out the trees, dumping it into a big thing that shakes it around and, you know, separates stuff, and spitting out crude oil, which would then be trucked all the way to Salt Lake City, which is about 200 miles to be refined there.
Okay. So how would you connect this issue with the tar sands resistance issue? Is this an issue where if people conserved their use of petroleum in this country, then it wouldn't be necessary?
No, that won't make any difference. People should, you know, conserve, you know, if that makes them feel like they're doing something, I suppose. But what we're really looking at is the ever-expanding fossil fuel industry. This is just another tentacle, another place where it's going to come and destroy and send more carbon into the atmosphere. It's a matter of leaving the carbon in the ground in the form of tar sands where it's safe, instead of perpetuating the fossil fuel industry's extraction processes The resistance doesn't have much to do with consumption habits. The resistance is going to come from putting enough pressure on government and changing the political climate enough through, you know, actions and you know, pointed messaging, which is what we're doing here at this conference, that will create the political circumstances that will support meaningful actions like a price on carbon or very, very increased amounts of money put into renewables or the end of subsidies for fossil fuels, et cetera.
Okay. And for this specific project, is litigation a tactic to stop it that's going to be used?
Absolutely. We are using litigation. A lawyer for Western Resource Advocates and Living Rivers, in conjunction with my organization, Peaceful Uprising, are issuing appeals and challenging the decisions by the board, calling for hearings. We're taking an all options approach to this topic. You know, should it get to the point where we have to move in with people to get in the way of the bulldozers, we'll take it there. But, you know, we're gonna exhaust all options along the way, definitely.
Okay. And you talked a little bit about the ecological damage it might cause. Is there also the potential for toxins nearby this extraction area and social impacts?
Absolutely. For one, it's a very long dirt road that they're going to have to widen for constant supply of trucks going back and forth, which will certainly affect, you know, the living quality of people who are out there. The chemicals they're using are proprietary. We don't know a lot about them, except they're strong enough to melt asphalt. They say they're safe, but they're strong enough to melt asphalt. I mean, that's what the tar sands are in essence. So they say they're citrus-based. However, we're not allowed to know what else the chemicals are in there. And the fossil fuel industry has a track record of promising chemicals are safe and then having them not be safe later on when people start getting sick. I think it's almost 100% record on that. So we're not trusting them. The state is, but we're not.
And this proprietary designation of the chemicals, is there legal action being taken to open up the record on that because this stuff's being used on public lands?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
That's a good question.
All right. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, the people that want to stay updated on this can go to our website at www.peacefuluprising.org. It's just all one word, and you can just click on the tar sands issue there, and we'll keep you updated on the latest on what could be the first tar sands extraction mine in the United States.
That was Ashley Anderson of the group Peaceful Uprising, working statewide in Utah and centered in the Moab area. Interviewed November 21st at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana. This is Oklahoma attorney Harlan Henches speaking at an Alberta tar sands panel held at the University of Montana on November 21st. I also interviewed Harlan Henches at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana. During an interview, Henches spoke about the government's environmental impact statement on the Keystone XL pipeline that is planned to connect the Alberta tar sands with the Gulf of Mexico.
My name is Harlan Henches. I practice law in Oklahoma, mainly represent farmers and ranchers. And you might wonder, why am I here? Usually when people come to me, they have one of two problems. The government's trying to take their land by eminent domain, or some big companies polluting all over them. And if you haven't figured it out, this pipeline through Montana, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas combines those two issues. So I was fortunate enough several months ago to meet Marty Covenace, and I'm so appreciative of of Marty and Heather for connecting me with the folks that are up here. When I have eminent domain cases, I try to align myself with property rights groups, and they're kind of way over on the right. And whenever I have pollution cases, I try to align myself with environmental groups who are way over on the left. And as near as I could tell, they have exactly the same set of values. They just don't think that they do. And this particular project has given me the opportunity to kind of explore that a little more thoroughly. Also, what Marty's given me the opportunity to do is to explore that geographically. to come up here from Oklahoma. I've also been working with the folks in Texas. What I've learned is that here in Missoula, you have some really strong young citizens who are willing to do some things that they call activism, but I call citizenship. And it's caused me to think about some historical things. And I mean like ancient historical things. Like, do you know what a Greek hoplite is? The hoplites were the heavy Greek infantrymen. They were farmers who, with the surplus they generated from their farms, would build shields and swords, spears, I should say. And then whenever it came time to protect themselves from the military and warlike Spartans, they would go out and line up abreast and about six deep. And each one of them would carry their shield. And the shield would protect themselves a little bit, but it would also protect the hoplite on their left. And they had to maintain that formation strictly and strongly in order to prevail. And because they were willing to do that to protect their property, they let a great civilization emerge. There's another piece of history, and this will sound biblical, but it's not. It's from Josephus, who wrote about the same time as the New Testament was being written. Uses one biblical character, though, Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate brought a Roman legion into Jerusalem, and the Roman legions carried these standards, and on these standards there were these big golden shields, and the Israelites thought that that was a graven image that the legions were bringing into their holy city. And so they showed up at Pontius's palace. The leaders came, and they brought lots of people with them, and they said, "We're not leaving until you remove that." And after some frustrating time listening to these rabble-rousers, Pilate told them that he was going to execute them all, and they bared their necks and backed Pilate down, and he removed the legions, and they prevailed. So these people who where I'm from, they think they're kind of radicals and extremists and things like that. They have some very, very important historical precedents and should be greatly respected. And I certainly do, and have learned how to do that, have learned to respect them much more over the last few days. But to get to Keystone XL, this is kind of an old picture of the pipelines, but I'll start with this. Keystone XL comes diagonally across Montana through South Dakota and then hooks up in Nebraska with a pipeline that it already exists called Keystone 1. And then from Nebraska, it comes down through Kansas and about one third of the way through Oklahoma to a place called Cushing, which is the oil pipeline capital of the United States. That's where Keystone stops, and then Keystone XL will be a new pipeline from Cushing on down to Port Arthur on the Gulf of Mexico. I will defer to Marty to describe many of the environmental impacts, but the thing that is most, the way that this most affects the people that I'm associated with, the people that I represent, is that TransCanada, which is obviously a foreign company, is using the power of eminent domain. Now, the power of eminent domain is the power of the government to take property that is owned by a private person and use it for a public use. Now, TransCanada hasn't been given the right of eminent domain by anybody, but they're saying that they have the right of eminent domain under the laws that you already have. So they come in and tell farmers that there's this big pipeline on its way through, we're gonna build it, we've got all the permits, you can't stop it, so you might as well sell your land to us. Another historical note, my family lives in a part of Oklahoma called the Cherokee Strip. The reason it's called the Cherokee Strip was because before the government gave it to my family, they had given it to the Cherokee Nation, after they had moved the Cherokee Nation from southeast United States to Oklahoma. And I've always been proud of that my family's always been there. It never occurred to me that government that had taken it away from the Cherokees and gave it to us was now going to take it from us. So there's another historical precedent that ties kind of Western civilization with the Native American civilization. One of the other problems, in addition to it, is that it's not providing a public service. The right of eminent domain was so that we could have streets without somebody standing in the way of something that was going to be good for everybody. Or maybe that we could have a railroad and even pipelines. I mean, the reasons that a lot of the natural resources in the United States were developed, it was made possible by pipelines. And that, in hindsight, maybe that wasn't such a great idea, but the pipelines that were built carried the fuel for everybody. You can't even say that about this particular pipeline because it carries fuel from a company that's in Canada all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, doesn't do anything for anybody in Montana or in South Dakota or in Nebraska or in Oklahoma or in Texas. So it just doesn't meet the requirements of eminent domain. But that doesn't stop the company from engaging in a misinformation campaign saying that this is for the public benefit, we're going to create lots of jobs, we're going to pay lots of taxes, and we're going to, and then my favorite is, this is for the national security. And Ashley mentioned that earlier. But the fact of the matter is, it's not going to do anything for our national security. This those politically and economically unstable foreign sources of oil in the Middle East, the tar sands oil is going to be just as politically and just as economically unstable, because what Jasmine's going to talk about is the Northern Gateway pipeline that goes to the West Coast, and there, so that the tar sands oil can be put on tankers to be taken to China. And China is backing the company, the Enbridge, that's building. Or at least that's what's being reported in not the environmental press, but in the industry press, that China is backing that investment so that they can take this. In addition, China has invested billions of dollars, I can't remember if it's $7 or $11 billion, in buying up the production rights to the tar sands in Canada. So to some degree, in order to get this oil down to the United States, we're either going to have to buy it from Canada or from China, or China may decide, no matter what price, they may not want us to have the oil if there is some political or military or economic reason why they would not want us to have the oil. So in that context, how has that improved anything from a national security standpoint? Nothing. In addition, we've just created about 1,500 mile long strip of land out in the rural areas where nobody can watch it, that is susceptible, that is 4 feet deep in the ground. So anybody with a post hole digger and some really dangerous stuff can create a really big problem for our supply. We maintain a very, very powerful military to make sure that the Middle East doesn't blow up the tankers hauling the crude from Saudi Arabia to the United States. What are we going to have to build to keep anybody else who has a problem with the United States from going to that pipeline and blowing it up? And of course, one of the answers is that we have a foreign policy that makes more sense than the one we have now, but that's another discussion. To close out, for those of you who aren't part of the summit, there's going to be a Missoula City Council meeting tomorrow night, and I'm leaving. I'm going to have to go back. I wish I was going to be there, because I would want to go and tell them how important it is that they know that there are people in Oklahoma and Texas and other places that are watching them to see if they have the backbone to do what the people who are at this summit have the backbone to do, and that they should be encouraged to stand up and do that, because other people are watching them, and not only that, but we'll support them. I can't tell you how happy I am to be here, and how happy I am to the people who've organized the summit to be here. Thank you all very much.
That was Oklahoma attorney Harlan Henches speaking at an Alberta tar sands panel held at the University of Montana on November 21st. I also interviewed Harlan Henches at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana. During an interview, Henches spoke about the government's environmental impact statement on the Keystone XL pipeline that is planned to connect the Alberta tar sands with the Gulf of Mexico.
I believe in March of last year. Gave everybody about 45 days to read the 2,000-page document. It was available online, but not in any form that you could actually search it in any manner. It was also available in rural libraries along the route, but far from any population center where the lawyers might be. Also, they had it on DVD, but they put each of the 2,000 pages in a separate file, so it took hours to actually get a version of the draft environmental impact statement that you could read. Nonetheless, people up and down the pipeline route read it, commented on it, got more time to comment on it, and because of those comments, the EPA determined that the EIS was that it was flawed, that it was insufficient, and told the State Department that they needed to do some work on that. And the State Department is in the process of redrafting its environmental impact statement. Until the environmental impact statement is redrafted and published again for public comment, it can't be approved. So we're now in a period where we don't know exactly what our time frame is, but we know that we've accomplished a significant thing in slowing down this process that previously had been like a train on a track.
And you mentioned the State Department, which makes me think, why not the Commerce Department on this? Is this going to be a Homeland Security juggernaut and they'll find an excuse eventually to ignore the environmental concerns because of some sort of national security reasoning?
Well, having a pipeline go from one country, any physical structure go from one country across the border to another country, is a significant impact on the security of the countries on either side. So that's why it requires a presidential permit. Whenever a application for a presidential permit comes in, it's the State Department's job to figure that out. Now, the question about national security is an interesting one because during the Bush administration, it was determined that in order to make the nation more secure, we needed to become less reliant on foreign oil and get oil from our friendly neighbors to the north, the Canadians. And that was the justification for the pipeline. But the fact is, the oil in Canada is being bought and is owned by, or portions of it are owned by, Chinese-owned companies. And when I say Chinese-owned companies, that doesn't mean privately-owned companies that are formed in China. It means companies that are owned by the Chinese government. So in order to get the tar sands from the tar sands to the United States, to some degree, the Chinese government is going to have to decide that they want to sell it to us. So from a national security standpoint, I don't know that these tar sands pipelines have accomplished anything. In fact, I would say they accomplished precisely the opposite. In addition, this as a security matter, having relying on a pipeline that's buried 4 feet deep, carrying almost 1 million barrels of oil a day to run your economy is a pretty dangerous thing, being that reliant upon a single source of oil that is so vulnerable over 1,500 miles of rural land 4 feet deep. That seems to me to be, if there's a national security interest involved, the security interest would indicate that you don't want to have the pipeline, not that you do want to have it.
So are most of the opponents against this pipeline totally, or are there some that would be mollified if environmental protections were put in place, for example?
Now the problem is that the people who are opposed to the pipeline for environmental reasons, are opposed to it because the tar sands are bad where they're produced, they're bad where they're transported, they're bad where they're refined.
But are there NIMBYs?
Well, I don't believe that there's any such thing as a NIMBY, because if you can do it, if you can do it in somebody's backyard, they can do it in your backyard. So keeping it out of your own backyard really doesn't accomplish anything.
That was Oklahoma attorney Harlan Henches, interviewed November 21st at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana.